The last queen of Hawaii died in 1917 at the age of 79, and 24 years after her kingdom was seized by the US. I'll probably
welcome
something. Shut
to
up.
Who's heads focused? I'm Rasmus.
And I'm red.
And I'm very confused. What the fuck is going on now?
Nah, just tired. That's all. How are you guys?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm good as well.
Oh, fantastic. I'm not sure if it's the meds or the lack of sleep.
Both.
Well, you said you pronounced medicine like meth, so I'm a little bit concerned.
That's what I heard too.
Well, to be honest, like, it's allergy tablets from the US, so it might as well be meth.
Careful.
Ooh. Powerful stuff.
Well, yeah.
Just to be clear, for legal purposes, disclaimer, nobody is taking drugs here. We are only taking medicines to get better.
Which, funnily enough, in the US is described as drugs.
Yeah, I know. That's why I feel the urge to be very precise that we are not from the US, and that doesn't mean the same thing.
No, yeah.
Allergies, you said?
Yeah, allergies are killing me. It's a hay fever and, I don't know, something other floating around. I mean, you can hear it basically in my voice. And it's been gotten to the point where I sleep like 2 hours each night at the moment.
That sucks.
Which also was one of the reasons why I had today off from work.
Good.
Because I wanted to, I took a day of vacation because it was yesterday there was a cooking class, which I attended, that worked out, which was a lot of fun. Oriental Kitchen. Highly recommended.
What did you cook?
Egyptian. It was basically, it was the basics. You had kofta, you had falafel, the different appetizers, street food. It was great.
Nice.
But so this morning, because I wasn't sleeping for the last couple of nights, I was so excited about it because I canceled all my plans that I had for today and decided to sleep in as long as I want, just stay in bed, read, and sleep some more. Mm-hmm. It was one of those lazy days. It kind of worked out. I woke up a couple times at night. I woke up at 6:30. That's when I decided to get up.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went back into bed and started my day with kind of reading the book and deciding, yes, now I'm going back to bed. I can already feel like I'm getting tired. And then my retired neighbor decided that he's going to take his pressure washer and clean his terrace.
Yeah.
He's really diligent about his work. So he continued doing that without a break till 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Oh, damn.
Starting at 9.
Oh. Wow.
It's a beautiful terrace. Now I'm blinded when the sun shines on it because he did every single centimeter with it.
Nice.
But it's one of those industrial ones with a like loud compressor on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And even with the double like glass plane windows closed, I was just basically laying in bed and thought to myself, somebody shoot me in the head, please.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of those days.
Yeah. So that was that. So no sleep. But that was my week.
Boom.
Sounds wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. Absolute dream. How about you guys? Brad?
Nothing new, nothing very noticeable. I tried to get back to work, finishing the belts batch that I'm doing at the moment.
Yeah.
Lot of stitching involved. Other than that, not so much. I'm getting a new graphic card for my computer, which is great because the warranty was still in play. So.
That's good news. I mean,
they are fair play because they wanted to check the thing, so I had to send it back and they checked and they said, yep, it's right. I told you.
Mm.
But yeah, they have to check it before. They don't have to believe me. And I get an upgrade because they didn't have the same graphic card that I bought last year. So they are sending me a new one.
Better?
Better faster. One. I had RX 6900 TX from AMD Radeon. And they are sending me the 7900. So it's way better. Instead of 6...
Oh, it's the newer generation of it.
Yeah, new generation.
You're hopping up a whole generation of cards.
Yeah. And instead of having 16 gigs, it has 20. So yeah, it's faster, it's better, it's gooder and everything. So I'm quite happy that
it's gooder. That's good.
Yeah, it's gooder. It's gooder. So yeah, it's been
now you have to upgrade your
everything
PC again.
Yeah,
everything CPU, because that's now gonna bottleneck.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it, but it's quite expensive. So
I'm just kidding. You're well set with that.
No, like, I'm well set. But the problem is, it was my kid's birthday on Monday, and we were thinking with my wife making him a PC actually, so mm-hmm. he can give me back my PS5. But he's a little bit young for that, so we're gonna wait at least one or two more years. When he will be in middle school, he will probably need a computer anyway for homework and stuff. So we're gonna basically save money and maybe buy parts and make him a PC for maybe next year or the year after. So at some point, I would have to upgrade mine and maybe give him some of my parts so he can build a thing. And so, yeah, we will be both happy.
So, recycling.
Exactly. Reusing, recycling, and repurposing, and saving money, and getting a better computer for myself.
Hand-me-downs are the best. I always thought my dad was so generous because I always got his old PCs.
Yeah.
But he was just saying, as big as a nerd as I am today. Yeah, he was looking forward to upgrade.
Exactly. That's what we do. We are dads. We have that kind of privilege. So yeah, no, but good week, feeling better compared to last week. So every day is a little improvement compared to the day before. So that's good. That's good. What about you, Raz? What did you do this week?
I have been forging knives all week.
Yay.
Sorry, you guys were just frozen for a second, so okay. I didn't get like the last 5 seconds.
He made a sword for me. That was
no, not
ah, okay, oh. Finally.
Well, yeah, but it's this big. It's this big.
A small sword.
I had a different theory because sword. I saw like the with the rounded blade. Oh. Are you talking about this one with the cookery? What's it called?
Yeah, cookery.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I told him it was probably trying to make a chef's knife, and then he started thinking about food again, and then it turned out like a banana.
That could have happened, but it didn't. The cookery actually is a project from last year at some point that mm-hmm. I finished forging now.
Nice.
Spur of the moment thing, because I thought like, oh, I don't have enough to do, so let me just toss this in the fire as well, because it's already hot, and I couldn't think of anything better.
And everything's more fun when you have a power hammer.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's So simply put, it just is more fun with a power hammer. And I think
it could be a t-shirt.
maybe that will happen. I have been thinking about merch things, but that's different. Where was I?
I've been making
knives. I've been making knives. Not swords yet, but I'm making increasingly longer and longer knives.
Good.
So I'm working up to it. Don't worry.
Good.
But well, the thing that I noticed, which was today, was it's taken me. I need to rewind a bit. I didn't mean to spend the entire week making knives,
mm-hmm.
but I was struggling with the forge welding at the beginning
mm-hmm.
because, well, I think basically I just didn't dial up the forge hot enough
mm-hmm.
and move it, and it was a bit further away from the power hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to rearrange things a little bit and then also crank up the heat, and it took me a little while to sort of realize that was the problem
mm-hmm.
to make everything stick together proper.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that on the first day, I got a third done of what I was very optimistically granted, but I only got a third done of what I was hoping to.
Okay. So it's good. Better than
I had
the fourth.
Another day. Say that?
It's better than a fourth.
It is. It is. But that means I had to spend another day making more knives.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that, oh, I have a custom order for a couple of knife plates, and the ones I made are a bit too small, so I need to make more. So I did mm-hmm. that today. But now I actually reached a point where it feels like good and consistent to do the forge welding in the forge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it's different for each type of steel as well. So when I forge welded the bigger knives that I talked about last week, with ATCRV2.
Mm-hmm.
That forge welded easily and without any issues.
Yeah.
But 1095 is a bit more tricky.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a learning curve to sort of dial back for a new type of steel and testing out and figuring out like, okay, this steel needs to look like this.
Okay.
And I need to treat it this and this way to make it feel good and stick. But then it's also sort of like, I can overdo it. I can be overcautious and quote unquote, never have a problem.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I need at some point to stress test
yeah.
the weld to see mm-hmm. where the limit is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I need to find an efficient process of consecutively getting good result while speeding up the process, not having too many heats, just refining the forge weld, if yeah. it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So I managed to do a bit of that today. And then I realized that, oh, but all of those small knives, I am a bit unsure about the weld in those. And I have a group of scouts from my old scout group coming by the forge next Thursday.
Okay.
So just to be on the safe side, let me make a batch of mono steel knife blades.
Let me test the knives on the scouts because that's how you do it.
Well, yes, it is the Norwegian scout. So, I mean, you always lose some along the way.
It's true. 10%, yeah. Always.
Yeah. Year by year, it's really annoying, but we just have to learn mm-hmm. to accept it.
Yeah.
But I instead then developed a good process now for forging mono steel knives.
Nice.
Which I'm kind of using the same process as for the laminated ones, except I can skip the whole forge welding step.
Yeah.
And I'm losing less material when I need to cut the material, because normally I have the spine of the blade being full of iron.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't cut away a part of that and then forge the point up and over, then if I were to instead to forge that down into single point, I would have a lot of iron contaminating the point of the knife and it will be weaker.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't have to do that on mono steel. Mm-hmm. So I figured out that, oh, if I'm kind of quick about it, I can forge one mono steel knife roughly to shape in about 6 minutes.
Stop bragging. It's not cool.
That's doing two at a time. because I cut if I'm going for a knife that is supposed to have 6 to 7 centimeter long blade,
mm-hmm.
I cut a piece of steel that is 13 centimeters long. I forge a tang down on one end.
Yeah.
And I cut halfway through the middle at that angle I need.
Yeah.
On the first heat.
Yeah.
I repeat for the second heat, break that off completely, mm-hmm. run over to the grinder, clean up the cut edge, mm-hmm. and then chuck them back into the forge.
Mm-hmm.
Then I spend one heat forging the distal taper in and forging the knife roughly down to size.
Okay.
So that's one more heat.
Yeah.
Well, one more heat per knife, but let's keep it one. Currently, I've used two heats.
Then I check the forge.
And I heat them up again, and then I spend two heats just refining the shape of the blade.
Cool. That's a good process.
Yeah, I'm kind of proud about that because
doing the
laminated ones, like you need to take a lot of time, and I mean nearly half the time of forging a knife is making sure that a forge weld is secure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If suddenly I don't need to wait for it get up to a bright orange or yellow heat at the beginning of each heat
mm-hmm.
to refine the forge weld, I'm not only saving the time in extra heating, I'm saving time. I don't have to do 5 minutes per knife of just forge welding.
No.
Or maybe even longer, depending. Like I think I basically got the forge welding down to be secure in 3 to 4 heats, depending on how it feels under the hammer.
Yeah.
And one heat is, I calculated being 2 minutes each, because it's 1 minute forging and one minute heating it up again, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing multiples and all of that, when I was doing the forge welding, I didn't feel secure enough, or like I had the space in the forge enough to have two pieces going at the same time.
Yeah.
So I would have one going and wait for that and make sure that is correct, and then doing the next one, which also slows down the process a lot.
Sure, but you're not in a hurry. And
well, it's production work, so...
Yeah, yes, production work. Yeah, no, but sure, it's production work and you have to save on fuel for the forge and...
Which also is a fucking bonkers. That's a different story, but yeah, go on.
No, but for how long can you keep that rhythm? for example? Like, can you forge that on that using that process? How long can you forge? Like 2 hours, 6 hours, 2 days, a week?
Using the power hammer, I can probably go the whole day.
The whole day?
Okay. Yeah. If I mean, I wouldn't want to do that 8 hours straight without a single break.
Yeah, that's my point.
I just want to say, as long as HEHD allows them.
Yeah, because you have to take some breaks at some point.
I don't.
And efficiency really only good if you consider the big picture of the of your day of work and not like forging in 6 minutes. But
oh yeah,
if it's only 6 minutes a day, it sounds like shit. If it's...
That's the average across the 12 I did.
Okay, cool. That's good. That's really good.
So yeah, that's a very good point. Like, I can do some things if I am well rested, have practiced beforehand, mm-hmm. and are really focused.
Yeah.
And really push myself. But that's not something I can repeat the whole day.
Yeah, because I'm saying that because I was thinking about the stitching that I have to do on my belts. And I can make belts all day, every day, for all week, and it would be fine. But doing the stitches all around the belt is so time-consuming. And so, like, it's the very boring part of the thing. And that's also what brings value to the belt, because nobody does it.
Yeah.
If you search for belt on TikTok, Etsy, or Instagram, nobody takes the time to do it because it is boring and it takes so much time. People don't need the stitching. It's just to embellish the thing.
Yeah.
But that's a real killer in the rhythm of my quote unquote production. If I skip that part, I would have finished the belt like long time ago. But yeah. I want to keep it because that's what makes the belts mine. And in my style, so to speak. So I have to be very careful where and when I do it. I have to be rested, as you said. I have to be in a good mood because I know it's going to take me like 3 or 4 hours to do it by hand. And after that, I'm not going to go for another one, like do again another belt for like 3 or 4 hours of hand stitching because it sucks. So that's why I was asking you, if the process is really good and you can maintain the rhythm for a full day, that's very good process. But if it's so exhausting or demanding that you can't keep it up for more than like 1 or 2 hours, the process is not that good.
Yeah, then you're at then I should have slowed down enough so that I can keep it up for at least a whole day.
Yeah.
Because long term, that is more beneficial, not only to me and my body and mental health, but also sustainably for the business. When I know that, no, this is the benchmark. This is the amount I can do in a day and go to work the next day.
Yeah. Because you were having Joe last week and I listened to the conversation. It was quite interesting two weeks ago, but I listened like this week, so that's why I'm confused and I'm tired and I'm old and fuck you.
cover everything.
but he was talking about the process that he has, and I remember being in a forge with him and watching him forge a knife in like I don't know, I didn't checked the time, but it was less than 5 minutes that the knife was done, and it was very impressive. Although he was doing something else after that. He was forging one knife, two knives, three knives, and then he was going to the grinder, and then he was tempering some other bits. And it's not like doing that only that all day long, because it must be crazy exhausting to have this rhythm. Well, Joe is a strong man and he's not easily tired, and he has the technique and the skills. But still, you also have to consider the mindset that you put in it, the concentration, the focus that you put in it. And if you are just slightly tired, you can fuck up the whole knife just because you are thinking about something else for like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was just a thought about.
But that's part of the practice, though. Not only...
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, part of the process is not only to get the practice and the muscle memory into your body, but also the mental practice of knowing that when I'm holding the hammer and the piece of glowing steel, that's the only thing that's the only thing that exists in my world.
Yeah.
And it takes practice to get
into that
mindset.
Because I can be stitching with like a movie on and listening to a movie or a podcast or whatever. I still know what I'm doing because it's so repetitive. It's like the muscle memories. It's left hand, right hand, you pull, you push, and you go to the next stitch, and that's okay. So I can be thinking about different things. It's not dangerous. The only thing that can happen is I poke my finger with a needle, and that's fine. It's not like hot steel that I would grab just thinking about something else.
No, but I'm sure you would be equally frustrated as I would if... I mean, I hopefully wouldn't be able to actually pick up a glowing bit of steel and really hurt myself. But it's kind of the same of like, if I brush my finger up against it, it's like the same kind of annoyance.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, sure. It's like, fuck, again. But you move on. You're not like...
And I did notice that when I was doing lots of forge welding, because like I had the dragon's breath coming out of the forge to get really the heat going. But that means that the tongs are getting hotter a bit further down. But of course, where I'm holding it, I'm keeping it cool.
Yeah.
So as soon as I just move my hand a little bit further up than what I normally would, just because I need a different kind of grip, I'm going like, oh, that's painful. I need to go back again.
Yeah.
But also, just to finish off with the whole gas price thing, I ordered more gas the other week, and I got an invoice for €120 a bottle.
Okay.
Plus delivery.
Okay.
And I was like, that seems way more than what I paid last time.
When was last time?
2 months ago.
Okay.
I paid €80 a bottle.
Oh, fuck. That's a lot.
So a 50% price increase. Granted, these are 33-kilo propane bottles, so they're fairly big. But also Norway is silly expensive, yada, yada, yada. Doesn't matter.
And cold. And far away. Yeah, yes, move on.
What's your point?
Norway.
And
what?
So I emailed them and I was like, what's this? Like, could you please just explain to me why there's been a 50% price increase in the last 2 months, in just two months?
Yeah.
And they immediately just said, oh, sorry, that's a mistake.
Oh, yeah,
you'll send your new invoice. And then I got thinking, I was like, well, hold on a second. And I checked, and 2 months before that, I paid €70 a bottle.
So that was also a mistake? For how long I've been mistaken?
That's the first time I started having a relationship with the propane company. That's when I bought like the first couple of
months. It's going to be hilarious when they say, oh, so we're going to send you a new invoice, and then you're going to get the two from the two orders before that for the 120. Or bad, please pay us.
I have no idea, but it's interesting to say
that.
But it's also kind of cool to know that actually just asking means that I suddenly got all that money back. I didn't have to pay all that much.
No.
Well, I mean, it's still
you don't get money back. I don't get money back.
I didn't have to pay
the right amount. Yeah.
And when, I mean, it's still €600 of getting four propane bottles to the forge.
Yeah, that's a lot.
So it's a substantial bit of money.
Sure.
Which is also kind of annoying, because even calculating all of this, like I could stick to the 33, no, I could stick to the 11 kilo bottles that I can get from almost like a what do you call it?
Gas station?
Or like a Home Depot style
self-service automated booth thing. Yeah, one of those. Whatever it's actually called. I forget the names at the moment. Vending machine. That's the word. Like a propane vending machine. I can go there.
You have propane vending machine? Like you put a coin in it and there's a bottle that drops?
No, because there are no vending machine.
Like,
Norway doesn't have cash anymore. There's no coin slot.
Yeah, no. It's
you swipe your credit card.
Yeah, you just tap it and it goes krudunk.
Okay, cool.
And if you're lucky, it's a solid bottle, so it goes krudunk and it stays. If it's a bad bottle, it goes krudunk and krudunk.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
You hear it snap off the vent on the back.
Yeah, but my point is, if I go to that machine, I will pay €40 for a bottle.
Yeah,
for that's 11 cheaper, kilos. But
yeah, it's only 11 kilos.
Yeah, so, but considering getting the bottles driven out to me, it is like this weird intersection of, it is still cheaper for me to buy the small ones privately at this vending machines, basically, every single time.
Yeah.
Also, especially because like driving to and from work, I'll drive past one just before going to getting to the house. So it's not a detour. Yeah, it's not an extra time.
It's only 11 kilograms, and the one you're getting is 33. So if you pay 80 for 33 kilograms and you pay 40 for 11.
But it's plus shipping.
Yeah, but it depends on how much the shipping.
Okay, I thought
it was 1500 or something. No, it's not fully 1500. It's sorry. Also, I'm mixing up the prices without tax and with tax.
Okay.
So it's 100 euros a bottle, including tax.
Okay. And how much is delivery?
And I think it's 130 euros plus tax or something. So that would go
for 4 bottles.
So for 4 bottles, I paid nearly 150 euros per bottle.
Okay, you would have to do the math, but if you are buying 11 kilos bottles, even though it's not a detour or anything, it's the time that it consumes to just get them and also change them whilst you are working in the
shop.
And the space.
And all of those things. So it is just at the intersection of considering the time spent and out of my day of getting them, changing bottles more often, losing pressure quicker in a bottle so it freezes over.
Yeah.
And all of those small things that I need to account for, it makes it just about worth it to just have the 4 big ones.
Yeah.
But of course, if I next time ask to have an extra 2 bottles delivered, I pay for the upcharge of buying 2 full bottles, which is 250 euros plus tax.
Okay.
So that's a fair bit to just buy the empty canister, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Get it full of repair as well. Then suddenly it's so much more cheaper that it's easier to do, kind of, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Can't you buy secondhand bottles? Empty bottles?
Probably not this size. I mean, maybe yes, if I'm lucky. But my point is being more like, I am kind of willing to pay that bit of extra to make my life in the Forge easier.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so that I don't have to think about that so often.
Yeah.
But still having the option of saying like, oh, fuck. Like what I'm doing currently, as I'm running all these 4 bottles absolutely dry.
Yeah.
And then I'm using the small 11 kilos one up until my next delivery.
Yeah.
And then I have the ease of practice and all of that of using the big ones again. If that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah, you have to do the math. Maybe you can get one of those tanks used from one of the like industrial places when they go out of business that you just put in front of your shop or on the side. And have like hard lining.
Oh, you mean like a massively big one?
Yeah. Because then you just pay for the transport, but you're set for a year, basically.
Maybe. I mean, I need to look into it, but I think that would be a big problem of being basically in a villa district.
Depends if
houses nearby and all.
It depends.
That.
You can put them underground, and that's not a problem anymore.
Yeah, but then it gets so expensive that he could probably buy bottles for years at the end before he breaks
even.
And
it's not my place, so I don't want to do any digging.
It's not your property.
Yeah,
it's not your place. That's a good point as well.
So yeah, if I were to be able to have like a 200 kilo tank that could get filled up and it was legal to store it outside. Sure, that would be interesting. But that's still a very big bomb if something goes wrong.
Sure.
Oh, that's even better, you just get yourself one of those gas transporters, like the smaller gas transport trucks.
I'll just buy it.
Plus, you have the joy of like driving from work and to work every single day with like sweat.
Why the gas company? Why bother? Like the gas company is fine; they will provide you for anything you need.
I think I'll just go for induction forge. I really want an induction forge.
Yeah, me too. I want to try it and can be very efficient, but still.
Anyway, we had a topic.
We had.
And then.
No, we still do.
The art of buying gas.
No.
Beans, lots of beans.
On toast. I was thinking the other day when I was making the Viking chest set for a client. The idea that I had all the way during the production of the thing was very close to the imposter syndrome. You know, when you are like It's not going to be good. I don't like the stage I'm at currently.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like shit. That's not the idea that I had at the beginning. So you go over that thing after a while because you know the material that you're using and you know that you have the skills and the technique. So that was not what was in my mind at the moment, when I was doing the thing. The idea was much more like, what if the guy doesn't like it because of the way I do it, because of my it's a big word at this stage of the conversation, but the creativity that I put into the thing. Basically, the client only asked for a Viking chessboard. He had the pieces and he wanted a leather board, right? Mm-hmm. So I could have done it thousands of different ways. And so we had an exchange conversation beforehand. I was like, I'm thinking this type of finish. And what do you think? And he was like, yeah, okay, for that should be really good. And let's go for it. But I only showed him a small sample of leather with all the different kind of finishes that I could do. And he never saw the finished piece until he received it at home and it was done, finished and everything, right? So during all this time, I was like, what happens if he doesn't like it, okay? Mm-hmm. Because his idea and my idea were probably different. And then I remembered, I tried to think about it and I regained confidence in myself, trying to convince myself that if the guy asked me to do it, it was because he'd seen the shit that I make and decided stuff that I make, and he decided that it was the direction that he wanted to go to, right?
Yeah.
And again, it made me think of something else. So it's a big introduction for the topic, but I'm getting there. Mm-hmm. Stick with me. It was the creativity, the decision that I made in order to create the final product made me think of a common friend that we have. It was always saying, oh, I'm not an artist. I'm a craftsman, right? I don't do art. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah, you do. Fuck yeah, you do, because of reasons that I would like to discuss with you guys, okay? Mm. So my question to you is, as a craftsman, as a maker, are you considering yourself as an artist? And if so, why? And if not, why the fuck not? I'm trying to push you in a certain direction and it's kind of obvious, but...
Yeah, it's a very... You're leading to witness.
Yeah, a little bit.
No, I don't think myself an artist.
Why that?
Because art isn't the focus. Functionality is. Or making it pretty is less important to me than making it functional.
Okay. So that's your main... The main reason is that you're making something that is useful.
Yeah. To me... I mean, it is kind of different. If I were to call myself an artist, then my sole goal would be to make things that invoke emotions. But that is not my goal.
Okay.
My goal is to make things that are practical, that is useful, that serve a purpose first.
Okay.
And then they can look good as a secondary thing.
Okay. But don't you think that your knife or anything that anything else that you make and sell can't induce emotions in the customer's mind, heart, or guts so why don't you call yourself an artist?
Because that's not my goal.
That's not yours, but that's the effect that you have on people when you are making a thing, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you're asking me about my opinion of myself.
Sure. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just trying to understand how or why a craftsman doesn't consider himself as an artist, even a little bit.
Okay, so let me do that, maybe explain it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I like to make things that look good.
Yeah.
But it needs to be it needs to look good because I am good at making the thing.
Okay.
Not because I'm good at making beautiful things.
Okay.
Do you notice the difference?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So that's my thing. Like, yeah, I people have told me, like they did to Steve, and he got way more insulted than I do. But it tell me that I make art. I make artful things. These mm-hmm. are beautiful. They evoke emotions in people. And I say, okay, thank you. But that's not my goal.
Sure, sure. I understand.
I want to do something that is different. A lot of the design things I do is because it is different than what is normally available, especially here in Norway. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying all of my ideas are very original. In my world, they are not, because I see so many other people doing similar or exactly the same things.
Mm-hmm.
But they end up different because I'm the one making them.
Okay.
That's kind of beside the point. It's more of just my focus is on the craft, the technique, and the execution of it.
Mm-hmm.
And because I want to master that aspect of it, I want the item to turn out beautiful and look good.
Okay. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. To me, it does. I would like to have Jan's input on it before I answer.
Well, I'm thinking about something different now. Is basically when it comes to art. For example, when I do the camera straps, mm-hmm. I don't see that as art. I see myself kind of as a, like, maybe in the beginning when I designed it, like as a product designer for it,
yeah.
but not in an art kind of sense. Then I was thinking about like practical stuff or the stuff I do in the workshop. And it's just like, yeah, I made the case for my brother, like with the holding the Hobbit book with the pipe and everything.
Yeah.
And you could argue that this is more like something an artist, because I came up with the idea how to showcase it, how to hold it, made it. It's a one of a kind piece. Basically, what I do when I'm in the workshop, I need an outlet, or the same with photography, because this is just to look at. There's not like, you can't argue that it's not art.
Yeah.
It might not be good. I'm not be good at shooting pictures. No, because I'm not shooting for money. I solely make pictures for myself.
Yeah, but it art, photography is not always art.
I'm not saying because it's photography, but because of the kind of photography I'm doing.
Okay.
Because I'm basically going on walks. I take my camera with me. I shoot and I develop my pictures for nothing. I shoot for the sake of shooting.
Yeah.
So and I would argue that this is art. But then on the other side is what my thought now is, that doesn't mean that it's good. It just means you can define it as art. Because for me, and I think this is why I distance myself usually from like telling anything in art for myself, is art for me is something beautiful. And in my opinion, 90% of the stuff I produce is shit.
Yeah, but you are judging your own art.
Yes, I know that. It's still that what you said, the imposter feeling, like it's still how I feel about it.
Yeah, and I don't think at this point, I don't think it's very it's anything to do with the imposter syndrome. I think it's like the very core of what an artist is to only notice the mistakes or the flaws in his creation and not see the beauty. And the beauty is not supposed to be noticed by the artist when the art is produced, when the product is done. When you are pushing the button on your camera, it's because you want to capture the beauty of what you are seeing.
Yes.
If the photo, if you judge the photo to be not good when it's developed,
mm-hmm.
You're judging the result of an intent that happened days ago, hours ago, months ago, years ago. And you're probably not able to see the beauty reflected in your photography, the beauty that you tried to capture reflecting in the final project. Doesn't mean that the people that will see your picture doesn't understand the beauty or get it.
Yeah, but this is something that is pretty common in photography, is for once like what you see and what you kind of want to capture. Mm-hmm. When I walk around with the camera and I see I see a picture, mm-hmm. or I see a feeling, I want to capture a feeling with the camera that I have in that moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I judge it when I know what I was trying to shoot at that point, mm-hmm. but it either works or it doesn't. And often it just doesn't, because you perceive it different the moment you shoot it, and there's just something wrong with the angle, with the perspective of it, and it does not work. And sometimes you and sometimes it works, and then you have a wonderful picture. And this is something that is quite noticeably, you will see if you have a photo gallery with a nicely shot picture where the photographer decided it was good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you will have people standing there saying, oh, that's a beautiful picture. That's quite measurable. If you hit a picture right, if the composition is correct on a picture, especially when it comes to landscape photography or on architectural, if you hit that right angle, you can convey that feeling and other people will see it in the picture. And this is kind of what you're aiming for. And this is something that either you're really talented or it takes a really long time to learn that, to like have an eye for it and shoot it, because you often see it, like you see a beautiful architecture, but to capture that in the camera and the right angle to convey it to other, that's what makes it difficult.
I understand, but that still bothers me a little bit, because it the difference between what you see and what you want to capture and the final result is not only on you. It can be because of the camera that you are using, the film that you are using, the sudden change in light, or because what you saw and what you wanted to capture birthed an emotion in you that is so difficult, so personal, and so difficult to translate into a fixed picture.
Yeah.
You see what I mean? Like, there's this guy, this famous photographer called David Hamilton. I, if I remember correctly, I'm not sure about the first name, but it definitely Hamilton. Fucking asshole of a pedophile, very well known for his young woman nudes. And he's been called a genius for like years and years. I hate his style because it's all blurry and it's all like suggestion, which is fine. Suggestion in nude art is completely fine. That's not my problem with it. The problem is that it's like, it's tasteless. It's like, it's blurry and it's like foggy. And so I don't like it. I really don't like that kind of pictures. Although this guy is very famous and everybody claims that he was, or is, I don't know, a genius, and it's like the most beautiful nude picture ever taken. No, I'm not sensible to that kind of picture.
Yeah.
My point being, it can also work the other way. You can produce something that you don't like, and I can find the beauty in that thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take
both ways. Absolutely.
Let's take a quick example. My favorite of all time piece of sculpture is Nike. It's the goddess of victory. It's in the Louvre in Paris. Okay. It's like this woman without arms, with just wings in the back, no head, no arms and wings, right? That's my favorite sculpture of all time. It creates something in me that is very, very difficult to express, but the intent of the artist was absolutely not that, because back in the days, a long time ago, this sculpture had a head and two arms and was very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even though now this sculpture is broken, I don't want to see it with arms and a head. I don't want to see it, because the feelings that it creates in me, the way it is now, is so powerful that I don't want to ruin that with the original creation, the original sculpture.
Oh, it's like a good, like that sculpture is like a good book. I've seen the picture. I know exactly what you mean, because I can like project it in my head. What you see there is basically the way it is. Yes, exactly. Because the way it is sculpted, you basically see.
Come on, you don't bring crafts to a podcast.
Yeah, but it's for our Patreons. You can see it.
Oh, okay.
Live on the Patreon thing.
Is it 3D print or is it a model?
It's a reproduction that my wife bought me from the Louvre. It's a smaller one, obviously, but it's a.
Oh, I thought you were really big for a second.
Yeah, I am. No, it's. I don't know the scale of it, but it's
about 20 centimeters tall.
Yeah, probably. But the scale compared to the original thing, I have no idea. But it's like the very well-made reproduction, which is, and that's my favorite thing of Paul.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Go on.
Anyway, it is basically you see the there's enough of the neck that you know in which way the head is turning. The arms, you can see it. It ends at the right moment, so your imagination can automatically complete the statue. Mm. And this, I think, is what makes it so special, because if there would be any more missing, like a piece of the shoulder or anything, then it could be anything. But you see what was intended or how it could have looked like. And your head automatically fills in that blank because the position and the pose is so natural of the statue. And I think this is what something. And this is also something you can recreate with pictures. Sometimes you have something missing in a picture on purpose, basically.
Yeah.
And you, whoever sees that picture just fills the blank in automatically.
Yeah, but
so
you see,
I love some pictures that do something with you. Like, it doesn't have to be, not everything has to be there. Sometimes just something missing is what makes it special.
Yeah, absolutely. And even though you are the one taking the picture and you know that something is missing and you wish the thing was not missing because the picture would be even better with the thing in it, the picture can still give birth to emotions and be liked by a lot of people.
There's a lot of pictures that are not bad. I've shot, since I started with the cameras, I shot thousands of pictures. I developed hundreds and hundreds I'm up to, I think, 130 film rolls now that I've developed, times 36 or 24, and that's not even counting the medium format. From all of those pictures, I have like three or four pictures where I hit it, like where I managed to do that. And I love those pictures. And the funny thing is like, because I develop them all and I have them digitally and I have the owner shared, I have friends going through the pictures and just like stepping through them. But all of them stop at the exact same pictures that I deem good. Mm. And say, oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
So this is something that is quite measurable. If something, if geometrical forms or if the feeling can be captured, correctly, then it is seen. And of course there's people that say, oh, I like this picture because of this or personal preference here, or I like this one because that was in Thailand, and oh, that beach looks absolutely beautiful. But they love it because of what's in the picture, not because of how the picture is shot.
Okay.
It's more of the symbolism of it than the art of the picture itself.
There's that overall, you can have people that like a certain detail about a picture, but it's the huge variety because of, like you said, like you don't like the blurry style, or you prefer kind of like a clear picture of something. And so then you have the personal preference of everyone. And then you have those pictures that are just good, like where you capture the feeling. And that's suddenly, like, even if people don't like the style of it, they see that something's happening there.
Mm.
And I think this is what every photographer is hunting about. And like I said, from the hundreds or thousands of pictures I shot, I only have like four. I can see later. Maybe I can upload one for the Patreons that I shot.
Yeah.
That I kind of like one of my favorites.
Yes, please.
Or all three of them.
Let me ask you this then. Raz, you said that your intent is to make something useful rather than to make something beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the 19th century definition the distinction between art and craftsmanship. It's in the Encyclopedia of D'Alembert or whatever.
Sure.
then a lot of French philosophers started thinking about that. And the reason being is that in French, the word craftsman is artisan.
Yeah.
And the first part is art. Okay. So in artisan, in craftsman, you have art. You have it's the same root. Okay. So a craftsman is someone that somehow touches very closely art. So they started, a lot of philosophers started to think about that question. Is a craftsman an artist? Is what a craftsman making art? Okay. And the very first definition of the very first person who wrote about this thing decided to make the distinction between craftsmanship and art between the, is it useful or not? Are you making something that has a use? Is it going to be used, Or if it's art, is it going to be just like looked at, listened to, and in order to create an emotion? Okay, it's like the very core of this discussion is that, is it useful or not? Is that only to produce happiness and emotions or not? Okay, so let me ask you that. You both said that you are not artists, although you are both the only ones judging what you are producing. So how can you be a good judge of your own production, saying that you are not an artist, even though both of you, as a goal, you have this feeling of making what you are making good looking and beautiful as it can. If it's a picture, it's a picture. If it's knife, it's knife. But your goal, beyond the fact that it's useful for your knives, Raz, it has to be nice. It has to be beautiful. It has to be good looking, attractive, so to speak.
Yes, but this isn't a fixed rule. But I feel like more often than not, if you made something that is supposed to have a function and it looks good, it will function better than the same item being ugly.
Why?
I mean, a simple thing is, if you have clean geometry in a knife, it functions better, it cuts better. And clean geometry is more appealing to the eye.
You remember the zombie apocalypse challenge that Rory did a few years ago?
Yeah.
He also did the quick and ugly thing, like make a tool, make a like jig, make a knife, like quick and ugly. Quick and dirty was the phrasing. Oh yeah, dirty Smithson. So quick and dirty.
Yeah.
You can be very efficient at making a zombie apocalypse weapon looking like fucking ugly, like rusted and heavy, but it would be very effective if you would like to crush someone's skulls.
Yeah, but then your functionality is also very crude. If you need to just bash someone's head in, you could just pick up a rock that's big enough. You don't need to shape it, or it doesn't need to be a beautiful rock.
A rock, it would be just exhausting and not very practical just to grab it. So a knife or a machete would be
rock
better.
On a stick, then.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, you are embellishing it.
I think I start to get red. So basically, if you're an artist or not, it's not determined by yourself, but by the people judging
your
work.
Thank you. Thank you, Jan. That's exactly my point. And I think that's the first step. And once you accept it, you can go all the way to the following step, maybe. I don't know. We should ask like real artists in order to check for that. But the second step would be exactly what I had when I was making this chessboard for the guy, saying like, no, that's the way I fucking do it. Let's put me, myself, my creativity, my choices, and my skills into that thing, because that's why he asked me and not somebody else. Like, assuming the creative decision that you make when you push a button to take a picture, to put a specific curve in a knife, or to apply the dye in a specific way on your piece of leather in order to create that effect that now you know how to create and to recreate. So that's functionality, create and recreate, but that you think will look good and that the client will enjoy as well. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. Again, to talk about Steve and Joe and those kind of blacksmiths that are making beautiful knives, they also choose to create a specific type of knife with specific curves, specific edges, specific kind of, I don't know, wood for the handle.
Yeah.
And the first thing that they will tell you when they are about to create a handle for a knife, it's like, look at that piece of wood. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, it's beautiful. So if you are using that piece of wood to create your knife, it's because you want to make it beautiful. You want a beauty to be associated with utility, with the purpose of a knife, which is to cut something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you would put, I don't know, the fucking ugly green epoxy or any kind of wood would work as long as it's yeah. hard enough to hold the blade, right?
Yeah.
So making the association of utility and beauty, you are making a conscious decision of adding value to the utility of anything that you are making, basically, right? And if you push further, the utility of the thing that you are creating disappears till there is only the beauty in it. And that's proper art, like a sculpture or painting. It's useless.
Mm.
It has no other meaning than creating emotions and just be beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and maybe you will agree or not, but I'm very interested in your opinion about that as makers, we are always trying to conciliate the utility of the thing that we are making and the beauty of the thing, like aesthetically pleasing beauty, not like astonishing piece of art that should be in a museum because it's point, like, yeah. I'm not saying that it's pointless, but it's a never ending research. Like you, it's, and I'm getting back, and I promise I will shut up. I'm getting back to what we were saying with Jan a few minutes earlier. Judging your own work is pointless because you are not able to judge efficiently and objectively something that you've spent so much time and energy and mindset into.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, we had at least one whole episode.
About yeah, I know.
Exactly that.
But it's just asking you, it would be just like judging yourself, like how good looking are you? You're a very fucking bad judge at that because there is stuff that you like in you and stuff that you don't like in you. Ask someone else, ask your girlfriend, ask a friend, ask your wife, ask your mother. They will have different answers, right? Yeah. So it's very, very hard for yourself to judge something that you have produced. Ask a mother if her child is beautiful. I don't know any mother that will say, no, he's fucking ugly and I hate him. No, of course, it's your child. You've produced it.
I have no clue what you're talking about. I mean, I'm absolutely perfect. My only flaw is my modesty.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
see what I mean? It's difficult to judge what you are doing. So you have to take some distance of what you are producing and let the customers or the public enjoy what you have made. And if someone, in my humble opinion, if someone is calling you an artist, that's fine. You are not only an artist. You are partly an artist. It can be 5%, 10%, 80%, but if you are a craftsman, you definitely put, and you definitely, you're seeking beauty to making something beautiful. You are putting beauty into what you are making. You are definitely at least in part an artist. That was my idea.
Yeah, I mean, I would never call myself an artist.
Yeah.
But I do recognize what you're saying.
Good, thank you.
But I don't know. It is something with the word artist that I feel has a lot of connotations in today's society.
Yes.
That I don't want to be associated with.
It's why?
Yeah.
What's the connotation?
I'm not even really sure. I feel like it just had this air about it of not taking the trade you're doing seriously.
That's something completely different what I see from it. But my understanding from artists is somebody that does art for a living.
Well, yes, but
yes, yes,
you're like, right. You are again.
If I may finish, yeah, yes, absolutely. It's an artist can very often be.
It'd be a musician, be in painter, be.
Yeah. Yes, all of those things. But to me, it has the feel of someone who is going solely being driven by emotion and not by the pursuit of making a specific thing.
Okay.
Does that, so, and that may, I know that's a very flawed contraction of it, but that's how it sort of feel in my mind, that it is an artist is someone who is a lot more temporary in their pursuit of something. It's more of a, I mean, that feels weird. I'm trying to grasp like the nuance that is the trouble for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the trope of the troubled artist. Like they create art because they are so troubled they can't do anything else.
Okay.
But this is what we do as makers. I mean, the reason why I go in my workshop is because I need an outlet for my creativity.
By all means, I know it's flawed. I know it's not the perfect thing. But we as makers, I would like to imagine, are doing things to improve upon something. Not because we have troubled on the inside and want to show that to the world.
Okay, I can maybe help here. Yeah. There is a French philosopher who said that the difference between an artist and a craftsman is that one is living to create, the other is creating to live.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There's this relationship with selling your work to make a living out of it, and the other being just alive and feeling this need to create something, even though it's not liked or appreciated, or it can't be sold. Like Van Gogh was never sold one painting.
Died penniless and all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, but he kept doing this because that's what his reason.
He was driven to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so,
So honestly, like that's actually a part of it, I think. I don't want to live in poverty because of making the things I like to make.
Poverty has nothing to do with it.
No, but that's a part of the image in my mind. Is that artist who dies penniless because he was so driven to only create.
Yeah, and I would add to that, in the French society, an artist is seen as like poor, as you just said, because he can't sell anything, but also lazy. It's a choice like, oh, you are choosing to be an artist so you don't have to be involved and participate in society and get a quote-unquote real job and do your 9-to-5 and all that shit, which is absolutely not true. Like, we all know Caro, she's a fucking brilliant artist. She's working her butt off to create everything that she needs to create in order to just live and make money. Yeah. But I challenge anyone to call her something different than an artist. Maybe herself will say that she's not. She's maybe just a maker, a craftsman, or a sculptor, or whatever. I see her as the pure representation of what an artist is. Doesn't have to crazy. Doesn't have to be poor. Doesn't have to be unsuccessful. Can be very talented. Can be successful. Can make a lot of money. Can be very asked by in the market. But she's still an artist. She creates wonderful stuff that we only that the sole purpose is to be looked at and enjoyed as it is, right? Caro, if you're listening to this and if I'm mistaken, please contact me. I hope I'm not. I hope I'm not, really. But
talk to Red. Don't send assassins.
No, but you see what I mean. There is this view on artists that is like really bad, and it's been since medieval times because they were not personally engaged in what would be normal society. They were not producing anything useful to survival of the society, the village, the town, or the family.
Yeah.
They were only there for art. And therefore, they have been like seen as outsiders. They are here for enjoyment. When we are having a big party and we need music, we call them.
Or to express feelings.
Or to express feelings, yeah.
Feelings or situations or emotions that other people are not able to themselves.
Exactly. But again, to my point, what the fuck are you doing and everybody in this era is doing after work? Most of the people, what are they doing? After the 9-to-5, they come back home, take care of the family, make dinner, take a shower, relax a little bit. But what are they doing then after that?
I would argue most people watch telly or play video games or something.
Yeah. So what is TV is like, you have this fucking talk show, but most of the time it's TV series and movies. What is a TV show? What is a movie? What is a video game?
Okay, yeah, I see where you're going.
If it's not art.
It is. And I guess that goes back to the whole medieval thing of they are creating a distraction from the horrors and troubles of the real world.
Yeah, not only, it can be also, you can educate people and you can distract them for everything that's ugly in the world, but you can also teach them a lot of stuff and move them in a very deep way.
In Germany, it's called Brot und Spiele, which basically means bread and games.
Yeah. But what would you learn going to see the games in the Roman Empire, like Gladiator?
No, it was entertainment. It was destruction. yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't want to be him. But beyond that, are you going out of the arena more educated or more inspired?
That's a whole different conversation, I think.
You
don't go there to have a lecture. You are not explicitly taught anything, but you go away with the knowledge of that guy probably deserved whatever put him there. I mean, that was the style of it at the time. Like, they were criminals who got executed.
Yeah, well, some of them had like superstar status.
Gladiators was a sport. We're talking of people who got executed in the games.
Oh yeah, those were like fuckers.
So there's two different sides of this story.
Sure.
You have the superheroes who were the gladiators who performed a sport. It was the ancient version of like the silly wrestling things going on today.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly it. They were telling a story. It was showmanship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or
the story was.
Same with the Olympics, same with like today's soccer games.
Well,
it's for entertainment. You're not walking out of a soccer stadium and you're subtly better at soccer.
No, you're not. But you learn a little bit of something on what teamwork can do.
I would argue that people go out of there and talk about the game and how like the different players performed, and it's more a distraction of everyday life and like a common ground to talk to other people about it.
That's where I started off from. It is first and foremost a distraction from the horrors and troubles of real life.
Exactly.
But you still take something away from it. Like there's a reason why Star Trek was so good when it first came out, because it was really, really distracting. But it was distracting you so much that you were willing to absorb the criticism of society it was created in.
Sure, but during...
As I said, it's a whole other conversation.
No, I don't think so. Because sure, it's art. Sure, it's distraction. Sure, it can go against what society think about the people producing it or watching it. But... I don't really know about Star Trek, so I'm going to just shift to Doctor Who, because that's the show that I know a lot better.
Mm.
I was rewatching an episode this week again, and I was like...
And everybody's surprised.
Yeah, everybody is. And I was like, fuck, that's only so well written that I still don't understand how they can... come from that specific episode to what's happening now in the show, but again, different story. And it's you can relate to the character, you can relate to their experience, you can relate to what's happening to them, you can learn and understand and feel their emotion. And you will learn about yourself, learn about other people, about the society, but learn about yourself. And that's what art is supposed to do, like create emotions. And if it's really well done, it will also teach you something. Where sports and people in arenas, you will have emotion for sure. You will learn shit. Again, yeah, if you're watching a soccer game, or football game, you're not be better at football. Yeah, you will learn maybe what a penalty is. But once this basic knowledge of what football is acquired, It doesn't teach you anything. It's just like...
I mean, as I said, this is getting... I mean, I would like to take this conversation a lot further.
Yeah.
But like, public executions was a thing, not only as a spectacle and a theater show, like as an actual theater show. It was supposed to be a spectacle that was distracting for the people, but it was also supposed to teach the public what can happen to you if you step out of line. That was never
you find out.
Yeah,
if you paint the wrong pictures, your head could be there and your body over there.
People were executed for blasphemy for that, for doing those kind of things.
Yeah.
At the same time, you have religious art whose main function wasn't to be beautiful. It was to convey the message of the Bible and educate people, right? But it happened to be
educate
beautiful.
People.
Well, I mean, yeah, no, they had a scripture they wanted you to teach, to learn. Doesn't mean it was good or true or anything.
That's
like
what
that.
I mean by educate people. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and so you have like whole different sides to everything, and everything, at least the way I see it, everything is about nuance. There's nothing in my mind that is solely good, solely bad.
Sure.
Everything is on a spectrum. Like, yeah, Hitler definitely was far off in one end.
Yeah. But as painting, you mean? Or the other one? Both?
This is a weird example to pull into the conversation now, but just because I said Hitler, everybody agree his painting was terrible and he was a terrible man. But also, every single historian would probably agree and say that he was kind to his dogs.
Yeah, probably.
So, by definition, he can't be 100% evil, even if you were to say that evil exists in this world, which I technically doesn't think it does.
Well, a cat person would highly disagree with you there.
Wilmins. I had one last question, sort of reverting a little bit back to the original topic, Red. And to also bring it to Japan. Is it called shokunin? Is that the expression in
shokunin,
Japan?
Yeah.
Explain that, because I just vaguely remember.
Shokunin is a working guy. It's the basic translation of craftsman. That is just like, But there are also a different word with its tatsujin. Tatsujin is like the fucking good guy at something.
But that's different from master.
It's close to master. Shogun is just craftsman, and tatsujin would be like master at something in a category, in a field, in a domain, whatever.
Okay.
And they are really, so if you are a craftsman in Japan, you have the respect of the people because you are creating what they need. You are contributing to society. Just a quick word about a long time ago in Japan, there were four groups in society. You had, first of all, the samurai, because they were fighting for your safety and for the lord, so they were higher in hierarchy. Okay. After that, you had all the people producing food, so peasants. They were making whatever needed to be produced in order to keep everybody's alive. Okay.
Yeah.
Then you have craftsmen, because they were producing everything that's useful in the world. Okay. Mm-hmm. And at the very fucking bottom of society, you have traders, because they are not producing anything.
You mean merchants, not traders?
Merchant. They are buying from something from someone, and they are reselling it to someone else, and they are making a profit. So they are only using people and what people are making in order to just live. So they are not very valuable in society. And after that, you have like real people outside of society, which is a completely different conversation.
They weren't counted, as it were.
Exactly. Almost not human. But it's interesting to see that now it's the other way around. Like the merchants are very high in the hierarchy of society, and not only in Japan, because they are the one creating the wealth of a country. They are taking from people producing something, and they are selling to people in need of something, and they are making big profit in the process. And those people who were not that long ago in different countries glorified as the new like gods of economy, It's very interesting to see how it shifted in a few hundred years. But that's another point. Tatsujin in Japan are the person really good at something. They are mastering their craft to the level of being the craft becoming art, so to speak.
Okay.
If you're still following. Like,
I think so.
A guy is gonna, and I'm gonna go far from producing something with wood or leather or steel or whatever, but there is a brewery of, that's a fucking hard word to pronounce.
It's fine.
Brewery. so they are taking rice and they are making sake. Okay. They are very, very specific process. And this sake is very famous because it's obviously delicious to most of the customers.
Yeah.
And the guy that came up with the process and is leading the brewery for so long is called a Tatsujin. So he's not only a craftsman, but he's not only a master, but he's almost an artist because the product is so good.
Right.
Right? So... And that's probably the reason why it bothers me so much when a craftsman says, "Nah, I'm not an artist." Of course you're not. That's not what you are called. That's not what you call yourself. But I can't stop myself thinking that in any kind of craftsmanship, there is part of putting your, we often use the expression like tears, sweat and blood into something.
Blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah, in different order, but that yeah.
In English.
Yeah. But what does it mean? It just means that you're putting your soul into it. You're putting your heart into it. You're putting everything that is you into the thing that you are making. And to me, that is the very definition of art. So even though you are not an artist and you don't want to call yourself an artist, if you are a maker, if you are a craftsman, you still are an artist at least a little bit, even though what you are producing is supposed to have a purpose. And
that's something to focus on.
Exactly.
Very well done. You want to start, Jan?
Yeah, then I'm going to start. I scrolled when I couldn't sleep through YouTube, and I found a guy called James Lambert.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, he plays around a lot with N64, like Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
And with playing, I mean, no, he is freaking good with it when it comes to programming. So he basically did Mega Textures in N64 hardware. He started porting Portal from Valve on N64.
No. Oh.
So he's basically seen how he can use the hardware of the N64 and like all the troubles of working with the old hardware. And the most incredible thing I watched the other day, and I think the video is only a week old, he N64 VR. He took the original Oculus dev kit from the VR glasses and got it running with like, I don't know, 20 or 30 frames per second on an N64.
Wow.
Well, 3D.
Okay, sure. That sounds very nauseous, cool. But sure.
Like this is it's hitting all of my nerd buttons. I enjoyed it thoroughly watching that.
Yeah, so and I just per minute. Per minute, you said? No, per second.
No. Per minute. Okay. That would be
that would be nauseous. But,
The lag and everything is horrible because he has to go through different adapters to communicate with the N64.
It's in none way
really practical, but just as a tech demo, that it is actually possible to run 3D on... Like with VR glasses on an N64, I find incredible.
That's great.
Damn. Ooh. Okay.
Okay.
That's James Lambert.
Nice.
Good.
How about yours?
Kind of in the style of the topic, I'm going with, I think, a video of Nerveforge from not so long ago.
Yeah.
Maybe last week. Maybe 2 weeks ago. I'm forgetting already. And it's Hansi who is going to see if he can learn how to draw in 100 hours.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the style of the conversation of like, how much does it take to be good at something?
Mm-hmm.
He spends only 100 hours of like a dedicated focus on something.
The only in your sentence bothers me. You can be super good in 1 hour. Depends on what you are learning. And the 10,000 hours is really about, like, it's bullshit.
Yeah. No, 10,000 is just like an arbitrary metric to say you spent a lot of time thinking about this and doing this thing.
It has reasons. It's about pilots and other stuff. But bullshit.
I agree. But I also mean, like, 100 hours isn't all that much.
No, but it's already a lot.
No, but...
stay 100 hours outside naked in the cold and you'll see it's a long time.
Shut up.
No, I'm going to ruin you.
The point is, if there's something you've been wanting to learn, just break it down into how much time you can dedicate to it a week.
Yeah,
they call that lessons.
By all means. But in this case... Like, if you want to learn how to draw, how long have you lived without feeling like you know how to draw?
Yeah.
Even if you can just set aside an hour a week, in 2 years, like, quote unquote, this is how good you can be.
Yeah.
That is my point. That's what I want to tell people.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, at least in my life, and as we've talked about many times, it is not about perfection. It's about improvement, continuously, incrementally. All the time.
Absolutely.
Maybe to my extent, a bit obsessively. But still, like, it is amazing to see how good Hansi can get at drawing after only spending 100 hours on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that is 100 hours spent with good amount of focus. It's over the course of just 5 weeks. So he's been able to spend a lot of time focusing on this in stretches. And that helps a lot. And he's going through more or less a lesson plan that Martina put together for him and all of those things. But still, it's my point of, no. If you spend just an hour a week, in 2 years, you've spent 100 hours trying to learn something.
Yeah.
And that is a fucking lot compared to not doing anything at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. Even a little every day is still better than nothing at all.
Yeah.
Good focus.
Nerdforge, Hansi, learning how to draw.
Very good. Talking about drawing, and I forgot to mention it last week, but it already happened at the time. I would like to mention Akira Toriyama.
Yes.
Which is who is the creator of Dragon Ball, amongst other stuff, and passed away, I think it was 2 weeks ago, at the age of 68, and is, to me, I'm not going to say he's one of the best mangaka in the world, he's the whatever. If you really look into what Dragon Ball is, all the characters are the same, only the hairstyle is different. Mm. But the characters that he created, the world that he created, as... inspired so many kids everywhere in the world. And if you're honest, you have to recognize that at some point in your life, you tried seriously to make a Kamehameha. So that guy has created dreams and inspiration in the hearts of so many kids and adults in the world that, I think it's very sad that we lost him and his creativity and his talent. So I just wanted to just mention the guy here.
He created Dragon Ball and what else?
Dr. Slump as well. And a few other things, but that's really the main two that he created.
Okay.
That are famous, at least.
Yeah.
So, Akira Toriyama.
Okay. Any last little tilly bits?
Nope. Not for me.
No. Then...
Oh, good.
I guess that's it.
Yep.
If you want to get a hold of us collectively, you can do that at 2/3 focused on any of the mostly social places.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find me at Rasmus Lewin and lewinsmed.no.
And you can find me at Doris Smith or Red Smith over on the internet, more specifically at dorismith.com.
And you can find me at Jan Maxwell or on NerdInventor on YouTube and Instagram.
Good.
Excellent. Thank you for listening.
Have a good
Thank
week.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.